Okay, so the last week we spent time on the big picture of the request of the two Shvatim. But I want to focus on a small detail, which actually closes out the Sefer, which is that one of the very strange things about the story, not in the big picture, but details, is that we have this whole back and forth between the two Shvatim requesting from Moshe to have their portion on the east bank. And then, out of nowhere, we discover, in number one, that it's not just two Shvatim, but it's 2.5. Part of Menashe also inherit with them. So the children of Machir, the son of Menashe, went to Gilad, and they captured it, and they kicked out the Emori who were there. And Moshe gave it to Machir, and he dwelled there. And Yair, the son of Menashe, or his descendants, we'll come to that, conquered Chavot Yair. They were named Chavot Yair. And Nobach went and captured Kenat and its dependent cities and renaming it Nobach after himself. So the last few psukim, the Torah tells you that in addition to the two Shvatim, there were a few Menashe families who conquered also on the east bank. And this raises many questions. Because first of all, were they part of this original request? If they are, so why aren't they mentioned? And second of all, why do they have to conquer it? Even if they are part of the request, so the two Shvatim before, Reuven and Gad, were given previously conquered land, why are we telling about this war? If they didn't request it, then why did they get the land? Third problem is that the simplest read of this, literal read of this, is that the people who conquered here have been dead for 200 years. Because according to the simple read of the Pasuk, the person who conquered this area is Yair ben Menashe, right? The son of Menashe.
Wasn't there something that they left Egypt on their
way? We're going to come to that, right? So the simplest read is that, simple as in the literal read, is that this is Menashe's son, Yair, who conquers it, who's been dead for 150, 200 years, who knows? Now, you could say that it means the children of Yair ben Menashe, but it's not what it actually says, and as we'll see, yes, there will be those who say that this actually happened then, but then you've got to figure out, when did this happen? When did Yair ben Menashe conquer something on the east side of the Jordan? When did that happen? But we'll see, there is such a pshat, and as we'll see, how to answer all these questions actually round out nicely so many of the themes in Bamidbar. Okay, so possibility one, if we want to take the, let's say, minimalist position, is what the Tzurah HaMor says. The Tzurah HaMor says, look, it could just be that the two Shvatim were asked for a portion on the east side of the Jordan. Menashe also asked for it, but they weren't mentioned because they were, minimal compared to the two Shvatim. And then at the end, it just tells you they went, and yeah, there was some land, there was still a little bit of conquering to go, but basically, the two Shvatim took the area of Sichon, but there was also the area of, like, Og, of the other part of the Emori, which hadn't been fully conquered, and the children of Menashe, and it doesn't really mean Yair ben Menashe, it means his descendants, they were part of that request, there was a little bit of conquering left to do, why don't we hear about them in the first half of the Perek? Because we didn't hear about them, because they were minimal. And that's what Tzurah HaMor says. He says, "Vim tomer miyichnes kan chatzi shevet Menashe kim lo shelu davar." Who brought up the half tribe of Menashe? They didn't ask for it. Maybe they did. It's possible that they also asked Reuven and God about the land of inheritance. But the Torah didn't mention them. The Torah didn't mention them because they were few. But what drives the Tzurah HaMor? The Tzurah HaMor says they must have asked. But why does he know they must have asked? Right? So there's a simple reason they must have asked, which is he just says, look, there are a few families, so it makes sense the Torah wouldn't mention them. But then he says a more fundamental point. He says it must be they asked. Because what we saw at length last week is that there's no way that Moshe would have initiated this. Right? The Torah Amor's conviction going into the story is that Moshe loves the West Bank of Israel. That's Israel proper. He might begrudgingly allow people to live on the East Coast, but what the Torah wants to leave you with at the end of Bamidbar is that Moshe loves Israel and would never allow this, and would never encourage this. He allows it begrudgingly, and therefore the Torah Amor says it must be that if you see the children of Menashe inheriting on the east bank of the Jordan, it's because they asked for it. And as I put here in the, the bullet point here, the Tzor HaMorah's sort of, now this story doesn't just to note, the story, it's here in Bamidbar Lamed Bet, but it's also the last story in Bamidbar, because Bamidbar Lamed Vav, which we saw 2 weeks ago, is the story of the same family who are the cousins of the Benot Tzlavchad, telling Moshe, we don't want the Benot Tzlavchad marrying out of the Shevet because we'll lose the land. So this is also the last story. I mean, here we find out that they get land on the East Bank, and the last story in Bamidbar is that they turn to Moshe and say, please don't let our portion that we've just fought for go to the other tribes through the marriage of the Benot Tzlavchad. So this story happens both in Bamidbar Lamed Bet and Lamed Vav, and it's the last story in the Sefer, which would mean that according to Torah Amor, Bamidbar wants to leave us with this notion that Moshe loves Israel and would never want anybody to go anywhere else. The Torah leaves you with the notion, but by the way, there were still other people that despite it all, didn't quite appreciate Israel, and till the end are asking to inherit on the East Bank or figuring it out. Okay. That is sort of the simple answer here. Okay. But this, we can expand this point. And this is something that Rai Helfgott wrote in an old article in Tradition, like 25 years ago. And he notes that if this is correct, that Menashe also asked for the portion, you actually have a fascinating pattern. Because he notes, Reuven, God, and Menashe share something in common. Reuven is the Bechor, period. He's the firstborn of everybody. God is also firstborn. He is the firstborn of Zilpah. And Menashe is the firstborn of Yosef. But not only that, there's a theme in Bereishis of rejected firstborns. Reuven is a rejected firstborn. Right? Reuven, Yaakov tells him, you were my firstborn, but pachas kamayim al totar. You were hasty, so you're not going to be the Bechor. Nor is Shimon, nor is Levi, it's going to be Yehuda. Menashe got snubbed by Yaakov when he switched his hands. God, I don't know, but the other two set a pattern. And he says, if you go through Bereishis, one of the meta themes in Bereishis, which we saw when we learned Bereishis 2 years ago, is of rejected Bechorers, right? Avram does that to his kids. Yishmael is kicked out, and Yitzchak is chosen as firstborn. Esav is kicked out of being Bechor. Yaakov gets to be firstborn. It happens to Reuven. It happens to Yosef, right? And it's replaced. And Yosef's kids, Ephraim and Menashe. But there's always two possible ways of interpreting the rejection of a firstborn. One is, I think we called it at the time, based on Rai Leibdek, Bechira or Bechorah. Right, what are you losing? Right? Are you losing your firstborn, but you're still chosen? Or are you being kicked out? Right? Is this an act of losing Bechora, or it's an act of losing the Bechira, of being chosen at all? Right? Helfgott looks at this and says, isn't it odd that the Shvatim that want to live outside of Israel are all rejected firstborns, are all firstborns who don't get to their rightful place, so to speak, in the family hierarchy. And with that insight, he notes that this story is quite strikingly parallel to a totally different story where another person is rejected from the family and his expression of rejection is going east. And that is Lot. Exactly, right? So if we look at the story of Lot, Lot is the other quasi-rejection story. Vayal Avram Mitzrayim, Huvi Ishto V'chol Asher Lo V'lo Nimo Anegba. Avram goes from Mitzrayim, him and his wife, and Lot V'Avram kaved ma'od b'mikneh b'kesev v'zahav. And Avram has a lot of cattle. And suddenly, he says the bells go off, right? Keep that in mind. What's about to drive the Lot rejection story is mikneh rav. There's a lot of animals. V'yelech l'masa av minegev ad beit el. Ma'kom asher yashama lo batchila b'im beit el v'nai. So he goes, he travels from the south to where he pitched his tent before, between Beit El and Ai. El makom mizbeach asher asher somebody shanav ekram sham Avram b'shem Adonai. And he goes to the mizbeach that was there originally, and he calls out the name of God. V'gam lo'od ha'olechem Avram ha'yatzonu v'karvo ha'olim. And Lot also has a lot of animals. V'lo nasau tama aret l'shevet yachdav, ki haya richu sham rav, lo yachlu shevet yachdav. And he said, we have too much property, we can't live together. So suddenly two themes, a lot of money, a lot of animals, and not enough space for all our animals, right? He's like, that, okay, we should already start, the bells should start going off. And there was a fight between the shepherds of the cattle of Lot and those of Avram, and the Kenani and the Perizi are still in the land. So Avram says to Lot, let's not fight. Not us, not our shepherds, we're brothers. He says, look, let's split. If you go left, I'll go right. If I go right, I'll go left. And Tova is correct. To understand the story, you've got to imagine it with a compass. They are facing the Jordan. So Avram says to him, look, we can't live together, but I want to both live in Israel. So go left or right. Left or right is interpreted as stay in Israel, go north or south. Right? If you're facing east, so go left means go north and I'll go south. If you go south, I'll go north. Right, left, fine. So Lot, right, so he's facing east, and Avram says, go this way or go this way. And instead, Vaisa Lot, but Lot doesn't go left or right. Instead, he just looks up and looks straight east. And when he looks east, he sees the Jordan River Valley. And he says, wow, the Jordan River Valley is really luscious. It's like Mitzrayim. It's like Gan Eden. So Lot says, let's go out. Let's go east. Let's go out towards the Jordan River Valley. Avram yoshev eretz Kenaan velot yoshev barei hakikar ve'yahalat Sdom. Manshei Sdom ra'im chateim la'adonai ma'od. So Avram stays in Israel, but Lot heads, he doesn't actually leave Israel, but he goes out east towards the Jordan River Valley and joins up with Sdom. And at that moment, Avram says, after Lot leaves him, this land is yours. North, south, east, west. Everything in Israel is yours. Etc. And in this story, there's many indications this is a precursor to the 2.5 Shvatim. Here you have Lot, who is a family member. Avram offers him, come, inherit with me. And he says, no, I have too much mikneh, I got too much cattle. Right, similarity one. I need a lot of land, there isn't space here, but there is in the Jordan River Valley, right, out east. He says, I'm going to go out east for money. Right? And he goes, and at that moment, as Rashi points out, acharei he pared lo meimo. Soon as Lot leaves, Hashem says, you'll inherit the land. Because Hashem tells him, the way Rashi puts it, once the Rasha has left you, now I'll talk to you. But in a simple read, what it means is acharei he pared lo meimo. Lot isn't part of Avram's family anymore. So once he leaves, Hashem says, I'm giving you the land to the exclusion of Lot. Lot has made his choice, he's going out east, but the land is yours. So Rehelfgat says, you know why Moshe panics? Because here you have three rejected Bechors who come to Moshe and say, we have a lot of cattle and we don't want the west side, we want to go east because there's more land. It's a luscious place for animals. And Moshe says, I've seen this before. This is Lot. This is somebody who thinks that they weren't just demoted from firstborns. They think they're kicked out of the family. And they just want to cut themselves out of the family, wipe their hands clean, and say, I'm done. And if you think about what Moshe said to them, Moshe, as we saw last week, gets furious at them and says, are you abandoning your brothers? Why did he think they were abandoning their brothers? Now, that's a bit harsh. So Helfgott says, no. Here you have all these bechors saying, it's time to go out east. Let's take the east luscious place for our animals. Moshe says, I've seen this before. Right? This is what Lot did. He wrote himself out of the family. Are you writing yourself out of the family? And they say either that's not what we meant, or that's no longer what we mean, which is what we saw last week. But Moshe is afraid that that's what's going on. And if you look at 5, when Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe actually inherit the land, this story happens again. Because as Yikra Yoshua L'Ruveni V'Chatzi Matem Menashe, Yoshua calls to the 2.5 tribes. Vayomer Aleihem, Atem Shmartem V'Kol Asher Tziva Atchem, Moshe Eved Anoivet Yishmu V'Kol Lilcha Asher Tzvi Yidchem. You've listened to everything that Moshe told you. Lo azavtem nechichem ze yamim rabim ayom azeh shmartem nishmer mitzvah adonai aleichem. You, oh good, there's Shemos on this. I thought I took them all out, but I missed one. Okay, so I'll take them afterwards. I'll put them in Shemos. You didn't abandon your brothers, and you kept your promise to God. Vata aniach adonai aleichem lachichem kasher diber lohem vata pnu v'luchu lochem lalechem el eretz achuzetchem asher natan lochem Moshe v'nanai be'eva yardein. And now God has allowed your brothers to get their portion, so it's your turn to go back to your homes, to where you've inherited on the east bank, which Moshe had given to you. Rak shimru me'od la'asod ha'mitzvah v'ha'torah she'tzivah etchem Moshe eved Adonai la'avod Adonai lechem u'lechem v'chol drachav lishmor mitzvotav u'dav kavo u'lavdo b'chol vavchem v'chol nafshechem. But make sure to keep all the mitzvot, and then in Vav he blesses them, and he outlines how much he gives them. Okay. Let's skip down here to Pasuk Yud. As they go back, Vayevo el Glilota Yarden Asher be'eretz Kanaan, Vayevnu v'nei Reuven v'nei Gad chatzi shevet Menashe sham mizbech al Yarden mizbech gadol limar'eh. And as soon as they get to the Jordan, they build a new mizbeach, a huge mizbeach. Vayishmu v'nei Israel lemor. The Jews here, the 2.5 Shvatim, have built a Mizbeach facing Israel. I mean, outside of Israel, but facing it. And the reaction is, the nation gets together for war. And they send a message to the 2.5 Shvatim in the hands of Pinchas. And they send many Nisiyim. And they say, skip down to Tet Zion. So said the nation of God. What is this trespass, this treason that you have against God, to turn away from God by building a mizbeach, to rebel against God? Was it not enough the sin of Peor, which we still haven't purified ourselves until now? It's been a plague against us. Now you're going to turn away from God, and tomorrow, and you're going to rebel from God, and tomorrow the Jews will be punished. If it's because you don't like the land you have, so come back. Come back to Israel. You think your land on the east side is impure, so come back and inherit with us on the west coast, but don't rebel against God. And then they compare him to Achan, who taken from the Chirem of Yericho. And skip the pasuk chav hey. Ugvul natan Adonai bnei uvenechem bnei uvenu bnei God of the Yarden and lachem chelik ladonai vishpitu bneichem et banenu vilti yarod Adonai. I mean, do you think that the border, the Jordan, is such a border that you no longer have a portion with God? Vanomer naset na la nanu livnodim is beach lola olava lola zavach. Sorry. He says, did you? So they answer, and they say, no, that's not what happened. We didn't do this. We didn't do it to lose our portion with God. We built the Mizbech not for Karbanot. Why did we bring it? In Chavchet, he says, no, it's just a sign. We put it as a sign to remind our children that we're still part of the Jewish people. So don't worry, we're not building it. We would never build a Mishkan that would separate us from, a Mizbech that would separate us from the Mishkan, and then everybody is happy. And they bless them, and they leave. But when they actually leave and they build a Mizbeach, right, why does everybody suddenly panic and say, you build a Mizbeach, it must be that you're cutting yourself off from the Jewish people and you're, don't do it, come back to the West Coast, right, the West Bank. The reason is because they're worried, right, and this fear perpetuates even after they actually fight with them. Are the 2.5 Shvatim trying to write themselves out of Jewish history? And they so when they see them building this bath, they panic and they say, you're writing yourselves out of the nation, don't do it, come back to the West Bank. And they say, don't worry, on the contrary, we're building a Mizbeach, which is identical to Mizbeach and Mishkan, to remind everybody that even though we're on the East Bank, not the West Bank, we still are part of the culture on the West Bank. It's a symbol, it's like a flag. Don't worry, we're still part of you. But Rehelfka takes these together and he says, why is Moshe panicked? Why are the Jewish people panicked? Because you have 3 firstborns who've all been rejected, who are doing what Lot did. They're going out east just because they have money, because they have property, they have animals, and they need lush land. The last time that happened, it led to Lot actually being written out of the Jewish people, out of Avram's family, and joining up with Sodom, right, writing himself out of God. And going with the godless society of Sodom. And Moshe looks at it and says, oh no, all the firstborns are writing themselves out of the people. It's Lot all over again. He says, don't do it. And they say, we're not. We're not abandoning. We're not Lot. Yes, we're going out east for money. I know it sounds bad, but we're not abandoning because we're still going to fight for the West Bank. Yoshua, 14 years later, says, see, you know, they conquered the they conquer the land, they go home, and everyone thinks they've dodged the bullet, and then as soon as the 2.5 Shvatim get to the East Bank, they build Arul's Mizbeach, and everyone panics and says, oh no, Moshe was right. They were writing themselves out of Jewish history. They're building their own Mishkan on the East Bank. And Moshe says, calm down. The Shvatim say, calm down. No, we're not. We told Moshe that's not what we're doing, and we're still not doing it. We're staying part of the Jewish people. This is a symbolic act to keep us tied to the Jewish people. But that fear, or as we saw last week, perhaps legitimate fear, right? Because as we saw last week, there's 2 ways of reading the story. One is that the 2 Shvatim didn't mean to abandon the Jews. Moshe misunderstood. Alternatively, Moshe understood perfectly well his Musar is what kept them in line. The same machloket emerges in the Yoshua story. Meaning, when the 2.5 Shvatim crossed the East Bank and built a Mizbeach, was everybody correct in assessing the situation that they were trying to write themselves out of Jewish history, but when they were faced with the prospect of war, they came up with a new interpretation? Or was everybody wrong? But whether they're right or wrong, the fear that everyone has is that this is a bichira moment, where they're choosing to be unchosen, as opposed to simply a bichara moment, where they're recognizing we're no longer the bichor, but we're still part of the Jewish people. So, the Tzur HaMoras read that the B'nai Menashe were actually part of this, leaves us with two themes as we leave Bamidbar. One is simply that, right, the Tzora Amora's conviction. Moshe would never encourage anybody to inherit outside of Israel. Bamidbar wants to leave you with the notion that Moshe loves Israel, even if everyone doesn't quite. But a much more meta level, if Rehelfgott's right, Bamidbar wants to remind you, as we're going into Israel, that while it's true, Avram's family is full of a history of Bechirot, where Lot is written out of the family, where Esav is written out of the family, Yishmael is written out of the family, the Bnei Keturah are written out of the family. Take your pick of people who are written out of the family in the early generations, despite the fact that it often looks like Shvatim are written out, or they try to write themselves out. The big change in the generation of Yaakov was that Yaakov's children, as much as they might sin, and as much as they might lose their privileges as firstborns and things like that, they're all chosen. And the magnitude of the rejection is much less. Instead of it being a moment of bechira, where they're written out, it's a moment of bechora, where they can lose privileges, but they will never be written out of the family. And Bamidbar ends with that emphasis. That as much as all the people who might think you might have thought were rejected, Reuven, bechor, who loses bechor, God, who has no expression of his bechora, Menashe, who's actively switched in Yaakov's hands, all those people who had it been Yishmael or Esav would have left Judaism, would have left the family. Everyone's afraid it's happening, but it's not. Right? It never happens. They maintain in the family, and therefore the Torah tells you that Moshe comes up with a way of keeping those rejected Bechors, those rejected firstborns, in the family. So that's read one. Right? Read one on this story that assumes that Menashe was actually part of this story integrally. Right? That he was actually one of the families of Menashe were those who requested it. I mean, if so, it's part of this general Bechor story. Okay. Read number two is Shaddal. Shaddal says as follows, Vayitein lehem Moshe, Ad kan lo nizkru b'nei Menashe, this is number six, Ad kan lo nizkru b'nei Menashe, V'nirat ki achar shiskim Moshe b'nei Ruvain v'gad latet et shelatam malchu b'nei Machir v'lachdu ha-gilad v'az yiskim Moshe gam im chati matem Menashe yishavu b'eivar ha-yardin. Shaddal says, no, Menashe wasn't originally part of this. What happens? Moshe, Reuven and Gad go and they request land. And after the whole back and forth, Moshe makes a deal with them. It works. They've agreed they're going to inherit. Menashe says, hey, I didn't realize that it was possible to inherit on the east bank of the Jordan. They go out. They don't ask Moshe. They say, if the east bank of the Jordan is game, then we'll go out and take some of it. And they go and they have some skirmishes and they conquer a few towns. And Moshe, post facto, says, okay, you can take it too. I've already allowed two. Go ahead. You can keep your land too. Now, Shaddal raises a totally different possibility, which is not that Moshe succeeds at the end of his life, but maybe he fails. Right? That Moshe tries to educate. Right? We saw last week that Moshe really doesn't like this notion. He begrudgingly goes along with it. Sure, inherit on the east bank. That's fine. But maybe, as much as Moshe is fighting, there are still some people who say, look, if the East Bank is possible, so we'll take it too. It doesn't matter that Moshe is begrudgingly giving it, that it's not a great idea. Okay. You know, and Bamidbar leaves us with the feeling that, yeah, you know, Moshe tried, and he was mostly successful, but you know what? Once you've opened the floodgates, it wasn't everybody. But there were some other people that Moshe said, look, once I allow it, there's some other people who are going to go along with it, including the Bnei Menashe. Now, it might not be totally the same. This is something we'll see, because it's possible that there's a distinction between the area of Sichon and the area of Og, and it's possible that the land that Menashe inherited, that conquered, was actually originally supposed to be part of Israel, which would complicate this, but that we'll see in a moment. But it's possible that Menashe is actually evidence of Moshe's fears being realized. That once you allow people to go on the East Coast, they're not, right? His fear was, are other people going to give up as well? They didn't give up, right? They're fighting, but there are other people who decide of their own initiative to go to the East Coast. Now Chazal, and this is actually I think the majority of the Mefarshim, take a totally different perspective, right? The Tzora Mor says, Menashe originally asked. Shadal says they didn't originally ask, but it was their initiation. It was just later in the process. The Yerushalmi, in one line, says no. Tani, asher natata li, velo shenatalti li me'atzmi. The halacha is, there are halachot of bikurim, of bringing the first fruits, and in that context, the pasuk says that you bring the first fruit, you bring them to Yerushalayim, you say to God, thank you for the land that you gave to me. So the Yerushalmi says, from the word asher natata li, we derive that the only land which you give bikurim from is land that God gave to you, not that you took from, that you took of your own accord. Now, right before that, the Yerushalmi had raised a position that said that the only place you bring bikurim from is the west bank of the Jordan, but not the east bank. So the Yerushalmi says, well, what's, if everybody in that context is telling us that you only bring bikurim from the west bank and not the east bank, so one pasuk, they derive it from a formal pasuk about what are the boundaries of Israel. He said, what's the difference between saying that the west bank is the only part of Israel that's actually Israel, or saying that the only part of Israel that's Israel is that which God gave, not that people took for themselves? So the Yerushalmi says, Ma beinehon, what's the difference? Amar, bi'aven chatzi shevet Menashe beinehon. The difference is the half tribe of Menashe. Meaning, if you think that Bikurim only come from the west bank of the Jordan, because the west bank of the Jordan is special, then even the portions on the east bank that Menashe inherited, you couldn't bring Bikurim from. But if the fundamental rule by Bikurim is you only bring Bikurim from the land that God gave to the Jewish people, and not from land that you took of your own initiative, so Reuven and God took their own land, but Menashe was given it by Moshe. Right, so the Yerushalmi says, no, this wasn't Menashe's initiative with Reuven and God, nor was it Menashe's initiative afterwards. Putting Menashe on the other side of the Jordan was actually a plan by Moshe. Right? Moshe asked them. Right? There were two Shvatim who asked Moshe, and then Moshe said, by the way, once I'm already doing this, I want a few families of Menashe to live on the east coast, on the east bank. So why would Moshe do that? Right. Why would Moshe, wait, last week, the whole thing we saw is that Moshe hated sending anybody the way to the east bank. So why suddenly would the Yerushalmi tell, and there's the Ramban and others, why would he say that Moshe sent them off east and he doesn't like it?
Well, because if it's only half, they're going to go visit their family. On the
good.
Other
so half. One of them, right, and this is, ironically, this doesn't come up in the Mefarshim, the early Mefarshim, but this is the consensus among modern commentaries, which I like. I gave it to you here, is unity. Right, is that Moshe's biggest fear was that this would be, as we've seen, the split of the Jewish people. So many modern commentaries say, what is the last thing you learn in Bamidbar? Is that Moshe wasn't going to take division of the Jewish people lying down. And he said, look, it's dangerous enough that I have two Shvatim living in the East Bank and 10 on the West Bank. But if I'm going to have that, I'm going to have to try to make sure that it doesn't actually lead to division. So Moshe says, I have an idea. Let me take one big family and split them up. Because if you put two all Shvatim on the east bank and 10 on the west, if you give it a few generations, and there'll be Bnei Yisrael and Reuven and Gad. But if I take one shiv and I split them, then that means there'll be a family who their cousins live on the west bank, and their cousins live on the east bank, and they'll maintain connection. And they will act to unify the people. So many modern commentaries have said, you know what the final act of Moshe is before we leave Bamidbar, is saying, I'm going to do everything to maintain Jewish unity. Even if I have to deal with two Shvatim who insist on being the East Bank, I'm not going to let it be 10 and 2. How am I going to do that? I'm going to take a Shevet and I'm going to split them up. And by splitting up a single Shevet, where they have familial ties, I will make sure the Jews stick together. Now, there are other possibilities. The Ramban says this was practical. Right? Namely that once you decide that the East Bank is going to be a Jewish settlement, you need to fill it up with people. So Moshe opens it up and says, okay, who wants to go? Who can help us? The Tzur Hamor in his second answer, the Netziv, say no. He was worried about their spirituality. And Menashe, These are the Nitzivrites. We're known as Torah scholars. And he said, okay, I need some spiritual guidance. I can't just send these materialists off out east. Right? I can't send the people who their whole thing was they wanted to be there for money. Let me send Menashe, who's also known for spiritual qualities. But whichever one it is, what these Mefarshim are getting at is that this last act tells you that Moshe he's not dead yet. And Moshe may be dying, he may be leaving, but Moshe is until his dying day, is going to be out there educating the Jewish people, and is going to keep the Jewish people together. And the last message Bamidbar wants to leave you with is even if he doesn't like the Dushvatim, he's not going to just let it be. He's going to come up with some way of maintaining unity, of making sure that those materialists aren't carried away. He's going to put Menashe there, either because they're spiritual or because they'll have family on both sides. Now, I gave you just from Al HaTorah a summary of what I just said. And they note that there are still some problems you have to deal with, such as why do they have to conquer, right? Meaning, why are they conquering new lands? So some of the Farshim say it's not a question. Really, this conquering didn't happen now. It happened earlier. It's just we didn't hear about it till now because it wasn't relevant. Meaning, there was Sichon who had been conquered by the whole Jewish people, but during those wars on the East Bank, there had been skirmishes, which Menashe had been involved in, and parenthetically, this happens now. Now, according to this explanation, it's not quite clear what would have happened if they had never asked for this land. Would it have just stayed as like an unprotected colony on the East Bank? No one quite knows. There are still some questions you have to deal with. But the fundamental notion that Moshe did this on purpose to maintain unity and maintain the spiritual status of the Jews who are on the East Bank, again, points to Moshe's leadership qualities in his final moments. Fourth possibility, and this is the last one, and by far the most surprising, this is the one that Tova mentioned before. So there's this weird, weird explanation from a student of Rav Sadia Gaon, it's quoted by the Abarbanel as well, who says, forget everything I just said. Everything I just said assumes that the psukim about Bnei Menashe are not literally the Bnei Menashe. They're the people, the descendants of Menashe living in the time of Moshe. But there is this possibility, and this is what Rav Sadia Gaon quotes as follows: Ukshemet Yosef ve'achav nitchazku ha'umot. A student of Rasajagon says no. When the story tells you that the people who conquered the land on the East Bank was the son of Menashe, that's exactly what it was. This is not 200 years later. The Torah is informing you of something you never knew, and that is, you think the Jews only conquered Israel in the time of Moshe. It's not true. There were early conquests in the time of the Shvatim. And the children of Menashe, you know why they wanted the land on the East Bank? Because Menashe, their great-great-great-great-grandfather, had conquered it 300 years before. This was family inheritance since the time of Yosef. And there is this whole tradition that the children of Yosef, Ephraim, Menashe, and there's all types of Midrashim built on this, we think they went down to Egypt, that was it. There's this tradition that's not true, that the Jews were going back and forth and were already starting to conquer Israel back in the time of the Avot. And the reason Menashe isn't mentioned here is because the two Shvatim are being selfish. Right? They're saying, look, we've all conquered new land, we want this land for our property. Menashe says, look, I don't want this land because I'm selfish. It's my land by right. We've had this land for 300 years. What do you want from 400 years? However many years you think they were in Mitzrayim. Whatever, we already did that. Right? However many years we were in Mitzrayim, this has been ours for forever. That's why we got the land. And I gave you here the summary in 10. That according to the student of Asajia, the cities mentioned by Mirror 32 as being conquered by Menashe had actually been originally conquered territories before, when Yosef was a vizier in Egypt. Abarbanel brings a similar opinion that Yosef had bought these land in the time of famine. At such point, they were conquered by Ammon, and now this land was returned to Israel's control. Menashe asked for their rightful inheritance to be returned. Now, Machir, Yair, and Novach, according to Rasaja's student, the verses refer not to the descendants of these individuals, but to Menashe's literal sons and grandchildren, as they were the ones who originally conquered the areas. So why did Menashe want the territory? Unlike Reuven and Gad, these families did not want the territory because it was good grazing land, but rather because the region had been conquered by and belonged to their ancestors. So why wait? Since Menashe's claim to the land and request of Moshe had nothing in common with that of Reuven and Gad, they did not join with them in the petition. Right? Why didn't they ask with Reuven and Gad? Because it had nothing to do with Reuven and Gad. It also explains a few other things, such as disproportionate inheritance. Right? The land that Menashe gets is massive. Why do they get so much land than everybody else? So according to this answer, it's because they conquered it hundreds of years ago. They were lucky. Right? That's like asking, why do real estate tycoons, right? Why are the heirs to real estate dynasties wealthy at birth? Because their parents did it before them. I don't know, right? Maybe it's not fair. Too bad, right? That's life. They inherited it. Different conditions. Moshe did not want to make Menashe's inheritance in the Eastern Sign conditional on joining the conquest, right? According to this, it makes sense why Moshe didn't say to Menashe, you only get it if you fight on the West Bank. That only makes sense if you don't deserve the land in the East Bank. But they did deserve the land in the East Bank. It was theirs. So it wasn't conditional. Now, the last thing, and this is why it's so fascinating, is the position raises fascinating questions regarding the mobility of the tribes in Egypt. Did they really have the freedom to come and go in Canaan, hold possessions there, even make conquests? If so, why did they stay in Egypt rather than turning to Canaan earlier? Right? This is the big question, which is, if this is true, then right, all of our understanding of Yetziat Mitzrayim is thrown into chaos, because if for a while the Jews were just in and out of the country, conquering lands in Canaan and coming back to Mitzrayim, then when exactly were they enslaved? When did that happen? It opens up all types of intriguing possibilities. Now, the person in modern writing who's really developed this is Yehuda Elie Tzur. And I gave you a summary of his article in 11. He notes that this thesis explains a lot of different things. So, for example, he notes that it's weird. The children of Menashe are named for cities in Israel, right? But according to the classic explanation, Gilad isn't named Gilad until 300 years after Gilad is, right? Happens the wrong way, right? Menashe names his kids after parts in Israel which are never named that until later, like Novach or Gilad. But according to this, it makes sense. No, they conquered it first. Right, Menashe had been conquering it hundreds of years before. So when he named his children, he named them for the land they were going to inherit in generations from now. He also notes that there's some interesting things that it explains. So one of them, and this is very technical, and you wouldn't catch it if you can't, you know, I never caught it because you need to know the map really well. But in Bereishit Yudalid, when Avram is fighting the war with the five kings, the four kings, that war. So the pasuk says, this is number 12, says, Vayishma Avram ki nishba achiv, vayarek et chanichav yolidei veito shmona asar ushlosh meod, vayirdof ad Dan. That Avram, when he was fighting the war, ran north to Dan with his 318-man army. The problem, right, you read that pasuk and you're like, okay, big deal. So he ran to Dan. The problem is that Dan is not in the north. Dan inherit in Tel Aviv, right? Gush Dan, until now, right? The buses in the Tel Aviv area are Dan. Right? Gush Dan, the Dan area, right? That's because that was the inheritance of Dan. They were in Tel Aviv Yafo. And that's not the north of Israel, it's the west. It's the west out by the water, right? Center west, not northeast. So why is Avram running out northeast? And why is that called Dan? So Yehuda Elie Tzur says, because that was where they were supposed to inherit. They're supposed to inherit. Originally, they were supposed to inherit in the north. And he proves it. Because you look in 13, when Moshe gives his bracha to Dan, he says, Dan Amar, Dan Gurayeh, Zanek Ben HaBashan. That Dan is a lion's whelp. He leaps forth from the Bashan. The Bashan is the north. All the way to the north. Like the northeast. But Dan doesn't live in the northeast. He lives in the center west.
But they did in Shofti, no?
And in Shoftim, well, right? But he notes, so when did this happen? So what Yehuda Elie Tzur notes is, well, look, once Reuven and Gad took parts on the East Bank, so what happened? You opened up portions on the West Bank, right? There was some horse trading going on. So once that happens, Dan gets moved around because you move Menashe up to the Bashan, like to the northeast. So Dan ends up inheriting primarily in the Central West, right? Tel Aviv. But if you look in Yehoshua and Shoftim, you discover that Dan actually never gives up on their inheritance. And he writes, he finds as follows. In Yehoshua Yotet, you find, Umeir Kon Rakona Gvul Mul Yafo, right? Dan was near the border of Yafo. So they go to the right out towards Yafo and they inherit it. Right, that's where they live, in Gush Dan. But in Shoftim, you discover that Dan actually had a hard time conquering Tel Aviv. So they decided to go on an expedition. And this is what happens in Yehoshua, in Shoftim, rather. This is the last source, 15. There was no king, and at that point, Dan was still looking for a place to live because they never managed to inherit their land. So they sent an expedition, and they sent them to Har Ephraim. Har Ephraim is northeast, right? North center east. So Yehuda Leitzer says, wait a second. Why is it that Avram runs northeast, and we call it Dan? Moshe says that Dan is supposed to be in the Bashan, and yet, in Yehoshua, they're in Tel Aviv, but then in Shoftim, when they failed to conquer Tel Aviv, they decided to go back towards the northeast. So he says, because apparently all the Shvatim had these little expeditions, all ordained the time of the Avot. Everyone knew what they were going to inherit. You think it only happened in Shoftim, in Yehoshua rather, that everyone inherited then with the Goral? It's not true. There were family traditions going back to the time of the Avot. Everyone already knew where they were going to inherit. There was some horse trading. Once Reuven and Gad ended up in the East Coast, it threw everything into chaos. You moved things around. Menashe moved north, and Dan moved out to Tel Aviv. But when Dan failed to inherit out by Tel Aviv, so they just went back to what they knew from their Avot. It wasn't only Menashe who'd conquered things out on the East Coast by Og. Dan had conquered things up north. Everyone had some stake in the land. The inheritance process, it started already in the time of the Shvatim. Rabbi Yitzchak Etshalom proves this from another thing, and he says, you want proof? Read Breishit. Breishit. Yehuda is a leader in the whole Yehuda Tamar story. Yehuda is running a whole tribe. He's the judge. Right? His daughter-in-law ostensibly commits adultery, and they bring her to Yehuda as the judge. He's clearly a political leader. He has the area under his control, vast tracts of land, tremendous amount of animals, and when a crime happens, he's the court judge, he's the governor. You ever stop to wonder, how did that happen? He said, well, because Yehuda already started inheriting. Yehuda went and he set up a little political area. He would started to be a governor. And he said, read the story. Yosef goes to Yaakov, and Yaakov says, go find your brothers. They're out somewhere. I said, where are they? Right? Where they have tremendous amount of animals with their own animals. Where are they living? Aren't they living in Yaakov's house? And he says, no, they're out and they're staking out their own land somewhere. He says, Reuven, in the middle of the whole sale of Yosef, leaves. And no one knows why he leaves. Right? Chazal have a whole theory why he leaves. He went to do tshuva. But he said, in simple pshat, okay, even if he went to do tshuva, where exactly did he go? Right? He went home. Right? He'd staked it out. The reason we don't think this, he says, is because by the end of Breishit, everyone's living at home again. But he says it's very simple, right? Your kid goes, they get a job out of college, they go and they're a big boy now, and they rent an apartment down at, you know, whatever, downtown, and then they lose their job. So what do? They come home, right? It's a famine. No one can afford it. Everyone moves home, right? Everyone moves home. But they clearly weren't living at home before, right? Suddenly, all 12 Shvatim, well, not all 12, 11 of them, not Yosef, obviously, right, are living at home again. Yeah, but they're living at home during a famine, so they all lost their jobs. So they all get together. They're living in about one big house. They're pooling resources. But until then, it was clear they weren't there. Reuven was out worrying about, they're all, right, Yosef has to be sent miles out to find his brothers who are clearly political leaders in other places. So this theory of Rasajigon and the Barmanello opened the possibility that we've totally misunderstood everything in Torah until now. You think this all happened hundreds of years later? No, you know, when the Shvatim were living there, they actually started this. There was some pre-existing framework. It obviously wasn't full because they went through the slavery and people had reconquered it. But people had a vague notion where they were supposed to inherit. They even might have conquered some of it hundreds of years ago. This was an ongoing process that got paused because of the horrors of Mitzrayim. But when they get back there, it's not like, hey, we're at Israel, the land of our forefathers. We never actually, it was just promised to us. They're like, oh, we're home, right? This is where my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather had inherited, right? And basically everybody, except the exception of the two Shvatim, were happy to go home. To their original promised land. There was a little bit of trading, a little bit of moving around. But you see that Dan, when it doesn't work out in his new territory, right? He goes back to the old one. Because he's like, look, if I can't inherit where Yoshua gave me, so, you know, Yaakov gave me a different property. Moshe had said my primary property is really up in the Bashan, not in Tel Aviv. So if I can't conquer Tel Aviv, so I'll go up north. I'll get myself a tzimmer up north and we'll be fine. Right? That's my property anyways. So you have these four very different theories, but each of them adds to our understanding as Bamidbar comes to a close, right? If the Tzoror Hamor is right, that Menashe requests the land because Moshe would never offer anybody in the East Coast, so the last story we hear about is Moshe's insistence, Ad HaSof, I'm never letting anyone go on the East Coast. If I have to, begrudgingly, fine. But you're left with Moshe's partial failure. Right, but his love of Israel and the complexity of what he's dealing with, which we've seen is an ongoing theme in Bamidbar. If Rabbi Helfgott is right, that it's not just Menashe happens to want to go on the other side, but it's these Bechors. So Bamidbar comes to a close with a story that started in Bereishis. Namely, Moshe panics at the end of Bamidbar, not just because people don't want to be in Israel, because he sees people writing themselves out of Jewish history, specifically the firstborns, the rejected firstborns. He says, oh no. Right? There are Shvatim who think there are another Lot, and another Ishmael, and another Esav. Right? My last move as leader is to make sure they don't write themselves out of Jewish history. Right? And therefore, I will make it contingent on them fighting for the Jewish people. And even Yoshua's time, right? They fight, they set up a Mizbeach, and everyone else panics and says, no, 14 years ago, we fended off disaster. Don't do it now. And they say, no, we're not doing it. We're not doing it. We're not writing ourselves off. But Bamidbar ends with a final reminder of what we started in Bereishis, is that while in the first generation, the second generation, the Avot, rejected brothers were written out of the family, by the time you get to the Shvatim, no one's written out. At worst, they lose privileges. And they may be disgruntled. But in the end, the Torah will not write them out of Jewish history, even if they are all the rejected firstborns. If Shaddal is right, that Moshe opened the floodgates, right? That once he said two Shvatim could go on the other side, so Menashe asks, and Moshe has to begrudgingly say yes, then Bamidbar ends on a bittersweet note, which is, as much as Moshe tried to educate the Jewish people, and he succeeded to an extent, 9.5 Shvatim still go to the West Bank. You know, Moshe's life was full of partial successes and partial failures. Bamidbar ends on the same tenuous note because, you know, that's life. It reminds us, you know, Moshe was a great leader, but even the best of leaders, you know, there are people who won't fully get their message. If the Yerushalmi is right, that Moshe intentionally put half of Menashe on the East Bank to make sure the Jews remain unified, because you have a family now who's going to be connecting with each other, with their cousins, or to give them spiritual aid, then the final story in Bamidbar is, by the way, as much as Moshe has had his difficult times up and down through Bamidbar, still, his final move will be to keep the Jewish people together and to educate them. Right? And Moshe, as much as he's had failures, remember that Moshe is still the best leader we've ever had. He made mistakes, he had problems, he got angry, he wasn't always successful. But in the end of the day, when push comes to shove, he knows how to deal even with sinners, even with people who are misguided, and he's going to make sure they're part of the Jewish people too. And if the Talmud of Rasajigon is right, so then we have a totally different explanation of this whole thing. Right? If the reason Menashe inherits on the east bank of the Jordan is because the actual children of Menashe had inherited, so then we have a totally different view of what Bamidbar really is, or what Chumash really is. because instead of what we normally think of, which is Chumash is the story of how we get to Israel, and right, Bereish is the story of the promise, Shemot is, you know, is Galus, Vayikra is Karbanot, and Bamidbar is getting to Israel. But between the promise and Bamidbar, where we actually get Israel, or really Yehoshua, there's just a promise. He says, no, you misunderstand the story. There was actually a continuous history that when Hashem said to Avram, you're going to inherit, Bereishis didn't end with just a promise. It actually, people were fighting. And even when you thought you were in Mitzrayim, there were families who were going back to Israel. We were always connected. Bamidbar isn't the story of how we suddenly show up in Israel after 200 years, 300 years, 400 years, 430 years, however many years it was, and say, we're home on a promise. The story of Bamidbar is of people finding the roots. Because as they get closer to the land, right, it becomes real again. And the B'nai Menashe say, hey, oh, this is the land that our great-great-great-grandfather inherited. It's time to come home. And they say to Moshe, can we have our land back? And Moshe says, sure. And they go, and they reconquer their land. And therefore, you have a totally different perspective. Bamidbar ends with a reminder, not that this wasn't just a promise hanging in the air for hundreds of years, but that it had started to be actualized and had been abruptly halted by the slavery in Mitzrayim, but even then, not entirely. And therefore, the return to Israel wasn't just the return of a promise that had, with no actualization, it was actually the fulfillment of a physical conquest that had started hundreds of years earlier. And Menashe is the one little hint that we have that that's true, because Menashe actually takes the land that they were in before. So, as I said, each of these different explanations of why Menashe isn't mentioned point to very different themes that end Bamidbar in different ways. But that really does bring us to the end of Bamidbar. I wanted, since we only have a few weeks left, to try to get at least an overview of Dvarim. And we won't get to, in detail, go through Dvarim, but at least to get an overview of what Dvarim is before we finish out the year.